Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, Rojo.
Good evening.
I've been looking at some of your writings, and I see that you cover a long range of subjects, from Yeshiva Zvolozhin to Chaim Grade, my favorite Yiddish author.
Mine too.
It is obvious that you have gotten a lot of your love for Yiddish from your father, Moshe Schechter.
Yes, I did, yes.
It is obvious that part of that love also has to do with Yiddish literature. And I'd venture to say you probably saw quite a bit of Yiddish theater.
Yes, but I'm less of a theater person than I am a literature person. I really do love to read, and I do love to write. And before I came to the Forovitz, I was actually writing short stories and songs. When they called me up and they asked me if I wanted to come work in the newspaper, I was a little bit nervous because journalism is a very different kind of writing than writing fiction or writing music, you know. So
absolutely.
But ever since I came, 1998, I've been very happy there.
Let's start by talking a little bit about you. What was it like growing up in the house of Moshe Schechter? What is it that attracted you towards Yiddish, besides the fact that it was probably required language in your home?
Absolutely.
What is it that makes you tick?
Okay, so if you know the story of Ben Yehuda, you know that he spoke only Hebrew to his children and insisted they answer him in Hebrew, even though nobody else at that time was speaking Hebrew. I think of my father as the Yiddish Ben Yehuda. Just like Ben Yehuda, he was helping writing the dictionaries and terminologies, and he insisted, Mered nur Yiddish, which meant that if we spoke English, we would not be able to watch television, because he assumed that's where the influence came. He tried other things. He also said to anybody who speaks English, you have to pay a penny. So the cup got bigger and bigger, full of coins. There are four of us, three girls and one boy. And many people have said to me, didn't you get angry that he forced you to speak Yiddish? You know, didn't you rebel against it? The answer is no. First of all, my father was a professor of Yiddish. He taught Yiddish at Columbia. He also had a very good sense of humor, and he loved children. He used to take us into the woods. He started a Yiddish club called Enge Benge, where he would get all the kids from the whole neighborhood that were children of survivors. He himself was a survivor. And we all know Yiddish because we went to a Yiddish school, Sholem Aleichem Shul Ein in Swansea in the Bronx. We would go to public school in the daytime and after
public school. It's interesting. Even in Uruguay, the first Yiddish school I attended was also called Sholem Aleichem.
That's right. It's a Sholem Aleichem.
Apparently, it seems to be a movement throughout the world that the first Yiddish school always has to be the Sholem Aleichem school.
No, there's also Yid Lamed Peretz Shul. That's the Arbeiter Ring, the Workman's Circle.
No, not in Uruguay. In fact, in Uruguay, the interesting paradox is that Sholem Aleichem was the modern non-religious school when they opened up the first religious school that also combined secular studies. The religious school was called Dr. Theodor Herzl. I don't believe for a second in the States you would ever find a film school, modern or otherwise, with the name of Dr. Theodor Herzl.
That's right. Yeah, that certainly wasn't what he was about. No, well, anyway, in America you have the Yud Lamed Peretz Shuls, where the Workman's Circle, that were completely secular schools. They only studied Yiddish and history. There was no prayer. There was no Hebrew. The school that I went to, which was created by the Sholem Aleichem Institute, was a more encompassing cultural school. So in other words, yes, we learned Yiddish language and literature, and we learned history in Yiddish, but we also learned Bible. We read Chumash Vakindah. We learned Hebrew language. We learned how to daven. I mean, I remember learning Yigdal and Adon Olam. You would never have that in an Arbeiter Ring Shul, in a Workman's Circle school. So even within the Yiddish school movement, there were different political movements. And ours, I think that was the best education we could get, because we got from everything, from Yiddish, from Hebrew, from history. And so as we grew up, and also my father sent us to a Yiddish camp called Camp Hemshech, which is no longer around. It was a Bundist camp. It was not religious at all. We were probably the only children who came from kosher homes. But there was Yiddish all around. There were the plays were in Yiddish. There were Yiddish lessons. The PA system would make announcements first in Yiddish and then in English. You know, so Oif Megzam, the Rusha is its Dareba. Rest hour is now over. So even those kids who came from homes where they didn't know Yiddish, there were some kids who were coming from suburbia. This was third generation already. They picked up the Yiddish from the announcement. So we had Yiddish in the Yiddish school. We had Yiddish in camp. And then after Yiddish school, we graduated from Yiddish school, we went to the Mittelschule, which was the high school that was meeting every Sunday in Manhattan. And after that, I went to the Yiddish in Lehrer Seminar, the Jewish Teacher Seminary, where we got degrees in Bachelor's of Jewish Literature. That was in addition to the degree I got at Barnard College, where I got a bachelor's, second bachelor's.
It's interesting that you mentioned that the Yitzchok Leibish Peretz schools were totally non-religious, because even though Yitzchok Leibish Peretz may have been a maskil, throughout his stories, throughout his writing, he shows a tremendous love, a tremendous respect for religion.
Absolutely. I don't know
whether the story is Oiv Nishno Hecher or Bon Cheshwaik. There is a tremendous love of religion.
Yes. But it is infused with socialist ideals, too. I mean, in both
Absolutely.
Cases, you have,
Absolutely.
You know, Chaver LeChavero seems to play a larger role than, you know, LeMakom. I think that's something that you do see in Peretz. But I don't think that Peretz saw himself as anti-religious by any means. In fact, at the Yiddish conference in 1908 that was in Chernovitz, the decision had to be made, was Yiddish going to be declared the Jewish language, in other words, meaning that Hebrew was not. And Peretz insisted, no, we have to say a Jewish language, not the Jewish language. So the Workman's Circle kind of adopted Peretz because they loved him as much as we did, but you're right, he was not anti-religious by any stretch of the imagination. He had a tremendous love for the masses, whether they were religious or socialists.
As a matter of fact, I found them more religious than Sholem Aleichem, even though Sholem Aleichem also shows a tremendous love, a tremendous nostalgia for everything religious throughout his story.
Right, that's right. And both of them, interestingly, and I say unfortunately, both of them did not speak Yiddish to their wives or to their children. I mean, it's very surprising because you'd think they'd have such a love for Yiddish, but they were both also assimilating, as many other Jews were at that time, assimilating to the secular culture. Because once they left the Orthodox lifestyle, they had the freedom, and the freedom was to speak whatever language they wanted. So why should their children speak Yiddish if if they were not religious anymore? They didn't feel bound to anything Jewish.
One of your articles that I found very, very interesting is Friday Film, Israel Under the Yiddish Microscope.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very interesting that in Eretz Yisrael, where even the Hasidim reluctantly speak Hebrew more than they speak Yiddish, somebody is making Yiddish films today.
Right. It's not
and
somebody. Those
films
were three.
Right.
Those were three
and
film students.
Right. And the three films that you feature sound very, very interesting.
Yes. And I give the readers the links so that if they like, they could watch the films themselves. Each film is only about 25, 30 minutes. So for
Shorts.
A small fee,
okay.
You get to watch the film, and they are all in Yiddish. Two of the films are mixed, Yiddish and Hebrew, but still you get the Yiddish flavor very strongly. Yeah, that was a surprise. Those films were done by the Ma'aleh School, which is the only, as far as I know, the only Orthodox film school in the world. And there they create films about Israeli life, about Jewish life. And three of the students decided they wanted to do it in Yiddish. Two of the directors didn't even know Yiddish. So in other words, they had to hire a specialist to make sure, you know, to translate the Yiddish parts for them. The third director actually did know Yiddish. But, yes, I found it very fascinating that Israelis today who used to be embarrassed to speak Yiddish because that was the galut and that was something that they were running away from, the newer generations now are looking at it longingly. You know, they're saying, and especially among the Ashkenazim, because the Sephardi Jews, even the younger generation, really kept up their link with their traditions, with their family traditions, with their religious traditions. Even if they weren't as religious as their parents, they still came home for Pesach. They still know how to make Kiddush. They had a love for their grandparents. The Ashkenazim were the rebels. Those were the ones who said, no, we're going to be Kechol HaGoyim. We want to be just like everybody else. And those children are now saying, but what about us? What's our culture? Culture didn't start in 1948. It started way before then. And now, and many of them are actually studying Yiddish. And in fact, aside from a number of Yiddish clubs that are that have started in the last 20 years in Israel, Tel Aviv University has a wonderful ulpan in Yiddish every summer. People come from all over the world to study Yiddish in Tel Aviv University. I'm sure that Eliezer Ben Yehuda is turning over in his grave because he definitely did not like Yiddish, nor did the first president, the first prime minister, Ben Gurion. When somebody spoke Yiddish in the Knesset once, who was a Holocaust survivor, she couldn't express herself in Hebrew. This was in the beginning of the state. And she stood up and spoke in Yiddish, and he turned to his neighbor and said, "That language grates in my ears." And that quote has stayed with him among lovers of Yiddish, you know, saying, how could that be? He came from a Yiddish-speaking environment in Eastern Europe. As soon as he came to Israel, he wanted nothing to do with it, and which is a shame. And so I'm glad to see that the younger generation, not all of them, but many of them are not embarrassed about it, are curious about it, learning Yiddish songs, and some of them are also taking Yiddish classes.
It is interesting what you said about Ben-Gurion's aversion to Yiddish, but that explains why a former friend of his who ended up being a political opponent, Meir Yaari, the head of Mapam during the early years of the state, who came from a Hasidic family, every once in a while in the Knesset would look over at Ben-Gurion's direction and throw in a few words in Yiddish.
Now you understand why.
Now that makes sense. Why would he look at Ben-Gurion talking? Now I understand the first day yet.
Right.
Now, let's talk about some of the subjects that you like to write about, some of the subjects that you cover, that you research.
Yes, I usually write human interest stories. For example, I wrote about a young Orthodox woman who has become a wonderful dancer, modern dancer, with an African-American company. And the conflicts that she has within herself, she wants to maintain her Orthodox Jewish lifestyle, but she also loves dancing. You know, I don't have to tell you, just like you have Kol Isha, you also have rules that women should not be dancing in front of other men.
Mm-hmm.
This was a decision that she had to make for herself because she just loved dance. She's very good at it. And she's made a career out of it, and yet she's to this day is Shomer Shabbos, and hopes that she will continue to be able to follow both paths, both loves. So that was one story that I enjoyed writing. Sometimes I also write investigative reports, not always happy ones. Unfortunately, there are cases of sexual abuse going on in the Hasidic community, in the Haredi community.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I feel it's important to talk about it. It's been hushed for way too long. And I do what I can. You know, you have to be very careful because usually when you speak to Hasidic sources, they ask you not to divulge their names. So very often when I write about them, I either say, you know, request anonymity, or I just make up a name. One of the stories which I found very touching was a family of two parents and four children who had been felt, the husband anyway, was not well treated by his parents. He was actually abused. And when he married another Hasidic woman of the same sect and they had four children, little by little they started moving away from it. They loved the Yiddish language, but they just couldn't bear the restrictions and the suffocation that they felt in the Hasidic community. So they left the community, but they love Yiddish. They continue to speak Yiddish to their children. They send their children to a modern Jewish day school. Obviously their families have, you know, don't have anything to do with them anymore, but they themselves call themselves Yiddishists. You know, they read the Forvitz. They came to the Yiddish Loch, which I'm going to tell you about that in a couple of minutes, because that's a subject that I've written about several times. And they're very eager to meet other Yiddish-speaking families so that their children can speak to other children in Yiddish, families that that are not necessarily religious but just love being Jewish and love speaking Yiddish. So the Yiddish Loch is an annual retreat. It's a one-week-long Yiddish camp where about 180 singles, couples, families, daughters and with their mothers, sons with their fathers, we all get together for a whole week. Everything is in Yiddish. In the dining room, everything is in Yiddish. The children play baseball in Yiddish. They call it hilke pilke because a pilke is a ball and a hilke is a bat. So they created the word. That I have that, by the way, from the camp I went to, Camp Hemshach. We called it hilke pilke. And netzball, which is volleyball, and koishball, which is basketball. And discussions and workshops and lectures and arts and crafts, and everything is in Yiddish. So it's a wonderful place for those, especially for the children who have been raised in Yiddish, like my sons have been. They had each other, but outside of that and their cousins, they really didn't have anybody to speak Yiddish to. But when they came to the Yiddish Woch every summer, they had a whole little society of kids, and they all spoke Yiddish. So that's something that that's very close to my heart, and as my children know, I expect them when they get married to speak Yiddish to their children. This way, I feel very strongly that everybody who knows Yiddish should do whatever they can to keep it alive.
Well, for a long time, Yiddish was rumored to be dying, but I'm afraid that actually not afraid, I am sure that the rumors are hardly very overblown.
Mm-hmm.
As I go around my own community here in Flatbush, there's quite a few Yiddish speakers, and not just in my generation, but in the younger generation. Yes,
right.
They do have a very heavy American accent, but no.
That's right. Well, the Lubavitch speak with an American accent. The children that I've heard speaking in Williamsburg speak a beautiful Yiddish. It's a Hungarian Yiddish. They mix in English words. But, you know, in fact, I just wrote an article last week called Hasidish Yiddish about a page on Facebook devoted to Hasidish Yiddish. It was started by a woman from a Satmar family who wanted to collect the words and phrases and the children's rhymes that she grew up with, that the Hasidic community shared. And so people just started posting. Hasidim and former Hasidim started posting that using Yiddish fonts as well. You know, you can write today, you can write with Yiddish letters also. And she got a list of hundreds of Hasidic Yiddish words and phrases and expressions. Some of them are very funny, and jokes and Hasidic tales and everything that they remembered from Cheder, from their families, from their friends in the street. It's a wonderful collection, and that was one of the most recent articles that I wrote about, because I want people to know that many young Hasidim today, just like we're talking about the Israeli young generation, among the Hasidim also, they're beginning to say, hey, we have this language that's ours, and this is something that we should be cherishing and not just using it because we have to. Because, you know, in many circles, the rabbis say, Techteret Yiddish, you know, you see signs plastered on the walls because they're afraid that they're going to be switching to English. But now some of those younger people are also saying, you know, what is it about Yiddish? Let's learn a little bit more about it. Let's be proud of it. Let's share it. And that's what's especially interesting is that they now have activities where Hasidim and former Hasidim get together with Yiddishists, both modern Orthodox and secular Yiddishists and conservative Reform, and they all get together and they read Bashevis together, or they read Peretz or Chaim Grada together. And it's a wonderful experience for both sides, because the Hasidim who come to these obviously are looking for a breath of fresh air, and the ones who are not Hasidim are looking forward to their learning, because the Hasidim know Lashon Kodesh so nice, so well, that there have been cases, one of the Hasidim told me in this article, that they were reading something by Bashevis, and a phrase came up in Lashon Kodesh that was not in the standard dictionary that we use, or Real Weinreich's Yiddish, English, Yiddish dictionary, but he knew what it was, because he knew Lashon Kodesh very well. He explained it to them, and they could go on. So I'm very thrilled to see Hasidim and non-Hasidim getting together to speak Yiddish. In fact, my son last year founded a farm in Goshen, New York, not far from Kiryas Yoel, called Yiddish Farm. It's going to be a place where Hasidim and non-Hasidim will work together in Yiddish, you know, whether it's planting vegetables or raising livestock, cattle, for shechting. Whatever it is they decide to do, it's going to be done in Yiddish. And I'm very proud of Naftali, my son, for doing this, for starting this, together with his friend Yisroel. It's going to be very interesting, because actually even now when they've needed to help with the setting up the greenhouse, they simply went to Kiryas Yoel, found some guys walking, young men walking on the street smoking cigarettes, and asked them if they'd like to help build a greenhouse in a Yiddish farm. Sure, they came, and they were a big help. So that's very interesting to see that coming together of two cultures of Jews, each being able to complement the other.
It also has another advantage. First of all, as I understand from your description, it breaches the large divide. After all, we're all Yidden. The anti-Semites,
right.
It makes no difference if you have Lange Pius and you wear Shkrimo, or you're completely shaven and you have a Jewish name.
Right.
And I am sure that Hitler, Yimach Shemoy Vezichroi, did not go around asking, do you wear Shkrimo, do you wear a Kippah Sruga, or...
Of course not.
You know, so...
Anything that contributes... Absolutely. But, you know, it's not just that. It's also that they're really learning from each other, not just that they enjoy...
They're learning from each other. They are understanding each other.
That's right.
And we realize that while some of us may be more or less religious than others, we're basically the same breed, the same type of creature.
Right.
And we have the same problems, regardless
right.
of religiosity.
Right. But, you know, in addition to my writing articles, I also have a cooking show on our website.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was going to mention that next.
Yeah.
Esgesin.
Mm-hmm. Esgesin to hate.
Okay.
And that's in English, it's eat in good health.
Mm-hmm.
Every month or so, we have another episode where my friend Eve Jachnowitz, who is a Yiddish cooking blogger,
has the blog in Molarein.
In Molarein, right. And together we make different Yiddish macholim, Jewish delicacies, in my kitchen with a cameraman there. And we have a lot of fun doing it. And we also get thousands of hits on YouTube, which is wonderful to see. I mean, some people tell me it's like watching their bubby in the kitchen, except that she's a little bit younger, which is, I'm happy to see people. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the first time I watched it, not only did I like what you were cooking, but I also love the fact that it was in Yiddish. It was
mm-hmm.
beautiful, and yet it was hilarious at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing I ever expected was to see a Yiddish cooking show. It was incredible.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't say it's hilarious. I would say that it's, you know, charming for people, because they're, you don't usually see people cooking in Yiddish anymore, except if you go in there with
correct.
That family. And I think it's a shame, because Yiddish cooking has, there are many... you know, words that are in old ethnic Yiddish words, authentic Yiddish words, that are getting lost because people don't know. They didn't listen to their Yiddish-speaking grandmothers when they were cooking. So we want, for those people who did maybe hear Yiddish as children, you know, to say, oh, I remember that word. You know, for example, the word upshel, to peel, or, you know, shulachts, which is the peel itself.
The peel itself,
you know,
right.
Different things, pomeranzen for oranges, or tzitzin,
yes.
Limina, you know, things like that. And they say, wow,
mm-hmm.
that takes me so far back. And also for those who don't know Yiddish, we have English subtitles. So I would say, venture to say that the vast majority of those people who watch our show do not know any Yiddish at all and may not even be Jewish. But simply we're looking how to make a certain Jewish food, and they came to this video. The one that we got with the biggest hits by far was the gefilte fish episode, because gefilte fish is so common. For many people, gefilte fish is Jewish. That is the Jewish food.
That is the
so
epitome of Jewish cuisine, yes.
Yeah, but we make
that
gefilte fish. We called it the real gefilte fish, because when I married my husband, Label, who's from Poland, born after the war, when he came to America, he said, this is not gefilte fish that you're eating fish balls. Real gefilte fish means stuffed fish. You have slices
right.
of carp with the bones in it, and the stuffing is put in between the skin and the bones. And then, you know, then you put it into water, into a fish broth, the way you do with the fish balls. But again, it's slices of carp with the bones and the stuffing. And he said, that's gefilte fish. So that's what we made for our viewers and show them this is the real gefilte fish.
You mean another myth of American Jewish life has just been destroyed?
Yes, another myth has been destroyed.
Oy, 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 gefilte.
Right. Of course, people are going to continue to call it gefilte fish, but we wanted to point out that it is a misnomer, that gefilte fish means stuffed fish. You know, having a whole fish and stuffing it.
Well, that's what my mother used to make. She was a prairie chef.
That's right.
When I came to America, I discovered that gefilte fish was something completely different than I had grown up.
Completely different. So you had the same experience as my husband, yeah.
Yeah.
And the last show that we had, we did it for Hanukkah, Lekuvit Hanukkah. We made latkes and we made punchkes, which is the Yiddish word for donuts. People always say sufganiyot.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know that. No, sufganiyot is what the Sephardim called it. But the Hungarian Jews did make donuts on Hanukkah.
And so did the
Polish
Jews. I grew up with punchkes.
Ah, so you heard punchkes also. Because I did not hear it growing up. In my house, we only made latkes. But I heard punchkes from the Satmar Hasidim. And then we, because the program was sponsored by Cherry Herring Liqueur.
Cherry Herring, right.
Yeah, we also made two drinks. One from with cherries. And cherry herring liqueur, and the other with their new coffee liqueur, which we made a
mm-hmm.
hot toddy with, you know, warm milk, and we made a froth, you know, the way they do with a cappuccino, and it was just delicious.
And you also had a very interesting show, which I enjoyed tremendously, with the cherries.
Oh, the sour cherries.
Yes, the sour cherries.
Yes, that was our very first show. It was dumplings with sour cherries.
Mm-hmm.
And for Americans need to develop a taste for sour, because Americans love sweet. They're so used to having a lot of sugar and honey and everything that when you teach them how to enjoy something that's sour or sweet and sour, you have to do it delicately. So I actually did put in more sugar into those dumplings than I would have done otherwise. Because I want people to be able to develop the taste for sour cherries. But sour cherries is what Vishniak is made of.
That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
My father, Lava Sholem in Uruguay, used to make Vishniak as well as wine. And, of course, his version of wine was mostly sugar. I think that if anybody would serve me my father's wine today, it would probably kill me with all that
sugar.
Yeah,
right. Sometimes they put in a lot of sugar if the grapes were not good enough.
Well,
I know
that's
what they do with
Concord
grape.
One of the reasons why, Concord grape and extra sweet Malaga. I mean, there is much sugar in it, because once they ferment, they are very, very dry, very sour.
Right, right.
Plus the fact that it seems that the European palate from pre-World War II was only used to sweet wine. I remember when my father came from Eritrea, he came to visit us. We used to live in Albany at the time, and I served them Asti Spumante, which is not a particularly sweet wine. It's sweet enough. He spit it out. He says to me,
oh, wow.
Also, is mein Wein in America?
So imagine if he had tasted Merlot. Merlot is
oh my God.
Very dry.
Yeah. Right. Okay, and we're out of time. There are so many subjects I wanted to cover that I'm going to have to
next
have
time.
You again. Yes,
okay, we'd love to come.
No. We'll have Zeyer Danken. Until them and in the program, thank you very, very much.
It was a
and
pleasure.
And good night, ladies and gentlemen. Come back next week on Wednesday at 8 o'clock for another interesting program. We will be talking to Reina Semnagar, cookbook author of Persian Cooking from the Non-Persian Bride. Thank you very, very much. Good night, one and all.